Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, go to our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of June 2026 and this is episode 385. In today's programme, I talk to novelist Andy Bell about his historical fiction book set around the Barnbow explosion and the women who worked in the munitions factory there during the First World War. Anthony shares the story behind his novel. Anthony, welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining us. We've had a couple of technical issues, but we are now operational. Now, to begin with, what first compelled you to explore the story of the Barnbow lasses? And why did you feel that fiction was the best way to honour the voices largely absent from the archival record?
Thanks for having me, Tom. The Barnbow lasses was something that is now pretty personal to me. I didn't really know about it up until a number of years ago, about 7 years ago, when I was researching my genealogy for the family. And the problem was that at the time, my grandfather told my mother that my great grandmother was killed on a hospital ship in the North Sea. And when I searched for her records, obviously there was nowhere to be found. There was no information from the Queen Mary's nursing service or anything. I couldn't find anything. So I had to dive deeper for her name, where she was living, where she was born and things like this. And then the only person I could find with Sarah Ann Jennings was this person who was blown up in the Barnbow factory. Then I researched the Barnbow factory explosion and what happened there and everything like that. So it's just really come about from there. I used fiction. I'm ex-forces, so sitting around telling stories is what we do. And I did that for quite some time. So telling stories is a bit of a pastime. So using fiction in order to get really into the nitty-gritty of what these women went through and the lives that they were leading. I mean, these are working class women in Yorkshire, and there's just not that much out there that is telling us about these women in a whole. So that's why I use the fiction sort of narrative, really, because I wanted to make sure that we were honouring these working class women as full human beings and not just footnotes, really. We call them the Canary Girls, but we want to know what their lives were like.
Indeed, I think that's really interesting. Now, before we get to the explosion itself, could you tell us where Barnbow is? Again, my southern accent probably has mispronounced it. And what actually stood on the factory before it became a munitions plant?
Yeah, so Barnbow is between sort of East Leeds and Garforth, which is West Yorkshire as it was then, that's basically where it stood. But before the war, it was just farmland. It was farmland, and it was far enough away from Leeds and Garforth. It was far enough away from there, but it also had railway access. It was just really farmland, about 400 acres worth, grazing cattle and things like that. So that's what that was like. By the time the end of the war came around, it was 400 acres of a city, basically, with fire stations and various other sorts of elements that was going to help the war effort and get these shells to the front.
And so what exactly was produced at Barnbow? What type of munitions were they actually producing, and what did a typical shift in a munitions factory look like for women like Eliza, Sarah and Lucy? And also, I wonder whether you could explain why they're called Canary Girls. I know you referenced that earlier, but it's useful just to, I think a lot of our listeners probably won't know what that reference is connected to.
Canary Girls is because the TNT that they were using in powder form used to basically They'd ingest it as they were filling the shells and things like this, and it was everywhere. The powder was getting everywhere. The dust was everywhere. So you couldn't help it. But the bodies all over the bodies, from the hair all the way down to the toenails, would just turn yellow. I mean, the hair would, depending on the colour, could go green or even blue. But so they just, I had that nickname, the Canary Girls, but it was from the TNT powder itself. The yellowing itself, all the girls pretty much went yellow, but the yellowing itself wasn't a problem. Once they finished working at that factory, the yellowing probably went after about 6 months to a year, the yellowing would fade away. But even if they had a child whilst they were yellow, the baby was also born yellow. The problem was, also came with sometimes with a number of women. There's about 400 reported cases of these women who also ended up with liver failure and various other sorts of issues. And of course, with liver failure, there is that yellowing of the skin as well. So, you know, they did have that sort of a situation going on. And there's about 400 cases, but there probably was a lot more. That history is not exactly recorded due to these working class women going home and dying at home. But so what did they make there? Well, they made sort of 4.5-inch howitzer shells. They made them with TNT and ammonium nitrate mix called Amatol. It was like a 60% TNT with a 40% ammonium nitrate. And what they would do, they would mix that together and heat it up into a large kettle. And then as the shells were going through the bench, they would then basically fill those shells up to a certain level, obviously with the Amatol, which made it slightly cheaper to make the shells, because TNT was extremely expensive at the time. So they mixed it with the ammonium nitrate in order to get this Amatol mix. Normally it was 4.5-inch howitzer shells. They also did 6-inch and 8-inch as well. But Baunbau itself was more of it was just a filling factory. So they didn't make the shells there. They didn't forge the shells there or anywhere. They'd come from other factories and then basically turn up at Baunbau, and then they would then fill them with everything that was needed to be filled, you know, to make the shell. And then they would pack them, and then they would go off on the trains to Holland places to get shipped out overseas.
So do I assume that they're producing the explosive part of the shell rather than the propellant which fires the shell?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so the high explosives is what they're basically packing into these shells. Absolutely right. So a typical shift would be they weren't 12-hour shifts at Baunbau, especially not in the room 42 where the explosion happened. There were 3 8-hour shifts. And so you would start about 10 p.m. on a night. In this particular case, for my great-grandmother, who was on the night shift, she'd start about 10 p.m. at night in the actual workshop, and then work through till obviously for the next 8 hours. And they'd have those three shifts, though they didn't. The idea was not to make them too tired so they couldn't function, obviously, during the whole 8 hours, because it was pretty hard work. There was a bench of 7 people, 7 women, normally within. So in room 42 itself, there's about 150 people. All on sort of benches of 7, with one charge hand, and then the other 6 ladies, and then you would have watchers walking up and down, and then you would also have inspectors within the room. And so really what would happen is it'd be a case of obviously making sure that the shells, the ones that had been left from, say, day shift, they were needed to be cooled down, and then they would go through the process, and then the new shells would be added and going through the process. So that all in all, by the end of it, you know, they were needing to fill about between 500 and 700 shells through the shift.
And what sort of pay did they get? Was it relatively well paid compared to other, I suppose, careers those girls could have had at this at that time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you look before that, it was in service or, you know, which my great grandmother was. She was in service before this. You know, she was getting relatively nothing. But when they started working at Barnbow, it was, you know, about £3 for the actual workers. The charge hand was getting about £4, but the watchers were on about £5 to £6. But even then, even though that was a lot of money for them at the time, due to the cost of living crisis. I mean, we talk about the cost of living crisis now, but I mean, then, you know, things went up like bread and milk and meat was had risen. The cost had risen by about 60% in Yorkshire. So, you know, it was pretty hard times for them, even the rents and various other sorts of things. So that money was very was very important to them. And so when which is what the book is named for, A Penny a Shell, when that actually, there's a bonus scheme that kicked in. And so really anything over quarter, they would earn one penny extra. So every shell that they filled over quarter, they would get one penny extra. So that money by the end of the week would have built up quite nicely, but it also put pressure on the ladies as well.
Yeah. Now, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording, and I was mentioning the Silvertown explosion in East London, where I think, you know, tens of women were killed in a munitions factory. And that's the incident I knew about, you know, in explosions, but not the Barnbow. And, you know, so tell us what happened on the night of the 5th of December when this explosion happened. And why do you think the disaster, despite its heavy death toll, has remained relatively unknown, and including, I have to admit, my ignorance of this incident?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, Chilwell as well. I mean, there was a huge explosion at Chilwell. It was nearly 100, I think it was like 170 people died at the Chilwell, and you know, lots more was injured. And yeah, and Silvertown as well, exactly the same. So there were smaller explosions around the country as well. So, but the Chilwell one is actually the biggest, I think. So for Barnbow on the night of the 5th, they don't actually, or the inquiry has never actually come out and said exactly what happened. It's all been a bit ambiguous right up and from the beginning of from the morning after right to today. Nobody's The inquiry never ever said what actually happened, and so nobody was put to blame. But there were things going on, things like the penny a shell bonus scheme, and then there was also at the same time as an efficiency study that was happening. And so these women were under a lot of pressure because they didn't want to lose this job. So they were also put under a lot of pressure in that sense. So what happened that night? The ladies started work at 10 p.m., leaving the canteen, going through into room 42, and they started work. And at 10:27 p.m., there was one of the shells detonated. It was a very there's many different factors, the molten amatol being too hot, or the maybe some of the amatol was leaked onto where they screw the cap and the fuse in, which then caused it to explode. So could have been many different factors that has led to that. But yeah, 35 women died on the evening on that. Well, actually 35 women reportedly died, but actually a number of them were sent to Leeds Infirmary and they died up to about 2 weeks after. One lady, unfortunately, she died about 2 years after, but really from the shock and the injuries that she sustained at Barnbow. So quite a number, you know, so it was a bit of a big death toll for Leeds at the site, certainly at the time. And of course they were reeling from the Somme offensive, where the Leeds pals took a heavy beating as well at the time.
So your novel follows three women over a 24-hour period as they go to work and obviously the explosion itself. How did you weave together the recorded testimony, the factory records, and also using a bit of artistic license to give, distinct feel of a world which is so alien to us in so many ways?
Yeah, so I've always been fascinated with history. My degree is in history, so... and certainly the First World War for me has been a passion as we we look back and being in the Air Force as well, obviously, you know, attending a number of Remembrance Sunday parades. So I've always liked to read up about this and obviously absorb as much as I possibly could when it came to that period of history. So really, as I started to write, and I wanted to portray three different women at different stages of their lives and why they were actually going to Barnbow. Obviously, my great grandmother Sarah Ann Jeans was one of those characters that I was putting across, and that pretty much, and her story is as much as I know from anecdotal evidence from my grandfather. So I tried to use as much of that as possible. But I used a wonderful book by Angela Wallacott, which is called On Her Their Lives Depend. So that was a really great resource to use. And then people like Claire Crossdale, who is doing great work for the munitionettes of Barnbow. She's doing amazing work. So I took a lot of different sort of elements from there and tried to weave it together in order to create the narrative of these three women as they go through that. I mean, I wanted to show, the Barnbow women, the Barnbow munitionettes had a reputation of being a bit raunchy and a bit, shall we say, they like to party. And so, there's lots of court records out there where a lot of them were fighting and drinking and God knows what else, right up until the point of some great information that is out there. But then I went to the Imperial War Museum, of course, and then they've got loads of archives of these women being interviewed in the 70s. A lot of that information as well in order to create this novel.
And is Eliza, Sarah and Lucy, are they real individuals based on your relative, or are they just people that you have invented as a vehicle to explore this disaster?
Sarah Ann Jennings is my great-grandmother.
Right.
And
okay.
I've said about Sarah and Thomas and her sister Annie and then her parents and Cecil, who is my grandfather. That is all, as far as I can get from anecdotal evidence, is true. All of that information that I've put in there about Sarah is the basis of the story, and it is pretty much true. Eliza and Lucy and their families and what they did, and all the other women that I use, all the other characters are fictional. The only other character that's actually real is Mr. William Parkin, and he was the hero of the evening. When the explosion happened, he ran in and saved 12 women. I used him and he's the only one that isn't fictional, so apart from Sarah and her family.
Yeah, now you mentioned the Penny Echelle bonus scheme, which introduces this system of incentivization and brings a degree of speed and competition on the factory floor. What did your research reveal about the real pressures created by this incentive system? You've touched on them briefly already. And how far did this undermine safety and maybe contribute to the disaster?
I mean, for me personally, reading through the research, yeah, I mean, I believe it. I believe that as well as the efficiency study, because obviously there was the shell shortage in 1915 and the British went through that shell shortage. there was a huge pressure to, in order to get more and more shells out. And yeah, and putting that penny a shell in place in order to speed the women up and drive them further in order to get more money, and the cost of living crisis that was happening at the time, and everything going skyrocketing high, you know, women were just chasing that money. There are incidents where some of the women were taking home 12 and 13 pounds on a weekly basis. So you know, that the penny a shell itself worked as such. You know, they really did sort of motor in order to get those shells through. But yeah, I believe it. I personally believe it created a lot of pressure. And I think it, for me, along with the efficiency study, by the end of, so once the explosion happened in December, by March, actually, there were 16,000 people working at Barnbow at the time. By March, actually, there was only 9,000 people working there. So the efficiency study is a real thing. And it you know, and I think both of those combined, along with the pressures of these women's lives, I think, I think that drove to create a situation where, you know, these types of accidents could happen.
Now, not to give away too much of the plot and obviously the tension that exists within the novel, one of the issues that you look at is Eliza and her decision to conceal the failing hydraulic press that forms, and this forms one of the sort of, I suppose, elements of tension in the book. How closely does this reflect the documented examples of equipment fatigue, equipment failure, and the impossible choices that workers face, maybe, you know, between survival and safety?
Yeah, I mean, there is documented evidence here with the Imperial War Museum. There's her name is Elsie McIntyre, and she's one of the ladies that was interviewed in the 70s for the Imperial War Museum. And she's talking about in that, she's talking about how they tried to nurse a lot of the equipment through, because the equipment was at some point failing, and so they tried to nurse that through because they didn't want to just stop the production line. They couldn't stop the production line, or they didn't want to, you know, in order to get these things fixed. So they tried to do their best in order to nurse them as far as they could go before they needed to shut down the line. So it was another pressure, I guess, to, you know, for that sort of added to a lack of safety on that sense. But yeah, I mean, the documented evidence from anecdotal as it may well be is, you know, is certainly there.
And do you think that, I suppose, the disaster in Room 42 obviously was an accident. Was this, I suppose, one of many that you come across? Or maybe there's many smaller sort of problems within the factory, people getting injured, but nothing on this scale. And does this sort of represent, I suppose, a broader pattern of, you know, they're running these factories at maximum capacity with a pretty, I suppose, it might offend all the health and safety experts, but very little red tape.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were a couple more accidents at Barnbow. I think one in 1917 where a couple of people died. But yeah, like we talked about earlier, which the Chilwell accident, I mean, that was probably one of the biggest, close to 200 people dying and a large number of people being injured. Yeah, I think, you know, looking at the research, looking at, you know, everything that's out there, I think yeah, absolutely correct in the sense of saying that they completely cut corners. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, they needed the shells. They needed to do what they needed to do, and I wouldn't say they were cutting corners in any sense, but I think they pushed maybe a little bit too hard in some senses in order to get these out there, get these shells across.
And you've talked about the official response and the inquiry into the explosion. would you say that I suppose response was slightly dismissive, and does it reveal a sort of a wider attitude towards the Ministry of Munitions view of women and their role in industrial labour, and also I suppose their wish to control the wartime narrative? You know, essentially they don't want these disasters reported on a regular basis.
Well, I mean, the attitude towards women during that time was clear. You know, that even though there were people, I mean, the train drivers and the tram drivers of London and things, that who were the women at the time, wanted equal pay, and they were told that they were nowhere near as good as men. But then, you know, in 1919, there was another study that showed that obviously there was no difference between how the women worked and how the men worked, and the output was exactly the same. They didn't want equal pay, but they wanted to know when they were leaving the trenches and coming back to work that their jobs were going to still be there and that these women were no longer required. I mean, the men would have earned two or more times. So yeah, a lady would have got the munitionettes would have got £3 a week, but the man would have got £6 a week. And so the Ministry of Munitions clearly showed each and every time when these women wanted to talk about getting equal pay or anything, that they were nowhere near, as far as they were concerned, second class. So it's that was that unfortunately was the way it went there. But by the time the war ended and these women were ready to, and then they had to close the gates, and then the men came back, and once they went back to work, and these women were left out in the cold, not earning anywhere near as much as they used to.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a time of the suffragettes, and many women are trying to get some form of political recognition for their work. And I was wondering, did you come across any sort of union activity in the munitions plant at all?
I haven't seen that, the trade union things through the munitionettes. I don't think that was, from what I can tell, I don't think that was the case. You know, like I say, the there were some workers' unions for the women in at the trains and the trams in London, which did have a strike. So, you know, there was certainly that, but I didn't see that in my research for the women. Certainly Angela Wallacott doesn't mention that in hers. I would imagine that there probably were some talks about that, but with the DORA situation as well for the women, they had to apply to leave the munitions factories and things like this. So it was it was very difficult for them as well to leave the factories. But yeah, when it comes to the Bambo explosion, the room itself, room 42, was by the next day was rebuilt, and new women were put in, and they were backfilling the shelves within 24 hours. Talk about the cover up, not in a modern day sense, but certainly there was a certain blackout in the way of press. The ladies who died, I mean, they didn't really, they got funerals, but they were not mentioned anywhere up until after the war. So they kept it as quiet as they possibly could. And even in the newspaper, I think it was the only thing they said was a northern factory accident in a northern factory. And that was roughly round about it. All of the women's death certificates say death by accident.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure. And I suppose, look, reflecting on that, what do you want readers to carry away with them after finishing your novel? And is there a particular misconception about Bambo or the women's war effort more widely that you hope the novel begins to challenge?
Yeah, I do. I want to make sure that people, especially young people today who don't realise everybody talks about the men and you know, going out to France and facing the grinding teeth of a machine gun, of course, you know, and that's extremely important, and that's extremely, we should be remembering that. But we also should be remembering what happened on the home front. We should be remembering what, you know, grandmothers and mothers and daughters and sisters, what they did, because it's extremely important, because without them, then none of that would have happened. We wouldn't have won, and we wouldn't have won the war, and we wouldn't be where we are today. And, you know, it's we've got to make sure that that is remembered. You know, they didn't just stay at home and you know, work in domestic service. They put their lives on the line. So, you know, I want that to be people's takeaway from this. There's also, I mean, the book doesn't just cover grief. It also covers, you know, the exhaustion, the poverty, but also a lot of hope. That's the idea. So, you know, that, you know, as we do move forward as a society, that people can certainly, when the next Remembrance Sunday comes around, this is something that they do remember.
And I suppose something I should have put in the questions was, but talking about memory and remembering, as you have done, is there a memorial to this disaster at all in Leeds?
There is. Manston, just outside of Leeds, there's a Barnbow memorial there, which names, has all the women on there, the names of all the 35 women. There's also in York Minster is the Imperial Women of the Empire Memorium, which is basically like cabinets as well. So you can go there, and there's all women who died in for the Empire in listed, and the Barnbow munitionettes are also there. Sarah Ann Jennings, my great grandma, actually, she's one of the only women mentioned on a village cenotaph. So, you know, so in her small village in Warthill, which is North Yorkshire, she's one of, there's only two in the country of a small village like that where they're actually, they mention one of the women who died. All the others really are very specific to munitions workers or to women as a whole.
And probably the most important question is, where can people get the book from?
Downloadable through Kindle on Amazon, or you can buy a paperback or a hardback cover on Amazon, Google, Apple, Barnes & Noble, pretty much anywhere really. It's only just released today. So it got released this morning, obviously the anniversary of the explosion. So I released it today. Hopefully bookshops and some other places, or maybe you can go in and ask for it.
Yeah.
So maybe we could do that.
And just for time stamping it, we're talking in December 2025, just so we're recording it then, just in case people wonder whether they're listening to it on the very day or downloading this podcast on the very day. Yeah. that. So on that bombshell, that's a bad choice of words. Apologies. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries, Tom. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Rusman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.